discussion now. We've got Cliff Begley, who gave a talk earlier, which again, you're welcome to put points to him in particular. So if anyone would like to start the ball rolling, having just witnessed that.
Right.
Yes. I want to know why he must have an apple glass and an half glass. It don't matter, does it? I want to know why anyway.
Capitalist society, you know we're living in capitalist society. It's buying and selling.
Yeah.
You must have buyers and you must have owners. Sellers. Buyers of labour power and sellers of labour power. We can't all be buyers. We can't all be sellers. We must have those who buy and those who sell. It's class divided society. This is how capitalism functions. And the most efficient way of it operating is by a minority of people monopolising the earth and everything on it and in it. Literally, they own it. You're born into that world of class division. You've got no choice but to accept your condition as a property-less wage slave, like most of us. It's in your interest to establish socialism with us. When are you going to join up? Because no one's going to do it for you. You've got to do it yourself.
There's a malfunction in this respect. This person does not sell anything. This thing about him, people, unemployed. Obviously, that's a contradiction to capitalist society. And how Jews are such a
quite missing aim to tackle unemployment. Well, he lives.
Well, the unemployment in this respect, I mean, I'll say this malfunction, see, is not selling anything.
I think I get the drift of what you're talking about. You're saying the person who's unemployed isn't in the working class. That's a load of nonsense.
Well, no, in respect, it's not working, no. It's not selling anything. You say work yourself and capitalize.
The capitalism needs unemployment.
Yeah, I know.
Because when it expands, these people come into operation. But he's still in the position of being a propertyless person.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And he has to exist on a handout, totally inadequate and poverty handout, from the state.
Of course, yeah.
And by the way, these handouts of welfare state were all introduced for the smooth running of capitalism. And they don't give these handouts for, out of their generosity. It's all geared towards the profit machine. Pensions, a lot of it. It's all inadequate, chronic poverty, but a little bit is better than nothing. Because if they didn't, capitalism wouldn't function. There'd be uprisings and everything. He's a worker. Like you, probably.
Can I just say, I think there was a second part of the question, which is where he said, how would socialism manage to abolish unemployment? I think that part got a bit lost.
Sorry, yeah. Socialism will abolish unemployment. Well, in a way, it would be, some people would say, a terrible society, because there will be mass unemployment, and everybody will be skint, because we're going to do away with the means of exchange, we're going to do away with employment. There won't be no coercion. You won't be forced to get a wage by working for somebody else. Why should you? Why should you have to work for somebody else to get something back? Be forced to go to work for 40 hours a week. And with the constant threat of, the sack hanging over your head. Why live like that when you can live like this? Why won't socialism function? There's nothing to stop it. The material conditions are here. It's in your interest to join us, You can work and, you're laughing and smiling away, but I'd like to hear your objections. Let's all join in the joke.
All right, hold on, there's a few people trying to get in now. Can we come back to you in a minute? Let's try somebody who hasn't come in yet first, and we'll come back to you in a minute or two, right? It's a bloke next to the door.
There's certain people that are excellent organisers, and there are other people who also like to be organised. So, therefore, I challenge your argument by suggesting that the present capitalist system, to an extent, I'm not saying it's perfect, but to an extent it works.
Well, capitalism doesn't work, never has worked. There's always been homelessness, insecurity, a lack of access to the best of medical facilities, transport, etc. Throws up a constant stream of problems, including the big one, threat of a third world war. Now, you say people like to be organised. So like, implied in that is people like to take orders. Well, I don't know anybody who likes to take orders. In fact, in the olden days, before the trade unions, you know, exerted their influence, he got foreman, and you still get it. I've been in non-unionised firms. It's terrible. They treat you like an animal. You do this, and you do that. Trestle spoke about it in the Ragged Trousers Philanthropist spoke. You know, who likes to be ordered about? I challenge you, I don't think anybody does. If anybody in here likes to be ordered about, stick your hand up. Hang on. Organisation is another thing. People do see the need for organisation. I do. And there are some people, might be you, might be me. I've got a loud voice, it's probably going to be me. In socialism, who's going to do the organising? We're going to say, we have these materials, we have this machinery, we have this people to operate it, let's solve starvation, let's build houses. Let's stop building means of destruction and all the other unnecessary features of this society. But, there's people who see the need for administration and organisation.
I think you'd have to come back for a moment, wouldn't you?
Well, I just perhaps have to agree with you as the first management. Organisation. Without management, I would have thought that you would have inevitable chaos. So I really do challenge you. And I don't think that every industry necessarily means that you are going to be ordered about, or rather the workers are going to be ordered about. But I really don't consider that a worthy argument at all.
People are being ordered about now in a way, aren't they? They're forced to go out to work. Forced to go out to work for a living. In the managerial class, by the way, you sort of like saying socialism isn't in their interests. They're sort of like, they're going to need an incentive to be managers. But there's managers and graduates on the dole now. A hell of a lot of them. Socialism will be in their interests. This money incentive to work, you know, they're going to be, socialism is going to be in their interest because it's going to be a society which is going to fulfil their material needs and emotional needs probably. It's going to get rid of the threat of war. And it's going to be a, you know, harmonious cooperative society. Right. Crime be abolished along with property society, which produces crime. Why shouldn't a manager, you know, we're really a small percentage of people anyway. Why shouldn't they be interested in that society? I don't see any reason.
There's a lot of hands going up. Can you just raise your hand if you are going to have a point to raise? I'll work out which order we're going in. Right, I want to give priority on the whole to people who aren't associated with the Socialist Party, but I'll make one exception because he's been waving his hand like mad there. Sandy, you can come in and then we'll go on to the other.
I mean, the whole point of the unemployment, the books right there, at least this point, is that it's really just the reverse side of employment. I mean, employment is obviously, if you're in a job, it's generally better than being out of one. Although some people have managed to find ways of, proving that, you know, being the exception that proves the rule, as it were. But there's nothing so great about a lot of the employment that's going about. I mean, far too many people do jobs that either hardly interest them or bore them stiff. And I mean, they're only doing it, as my uncle rather graphically put it once, to pay their store book. He was talking about the cooperative store book, incidentally. In other words, to keep the wolf away from the door, to buy the necessaries of life. That's the strongest motivation that a lot of people have for doing the jobs that they're doing. Not to actually because they feel that they're producing something worthwhile. Well, I mean, they may know that they are. They may actually be producing, say, surgical bandages or something. And, they may be quite conscious of this fact, but it doesn't figure sort of greatly in their attitudes to work a lot of the time. And as far as this question of organisation is concerned, I mean, there seems to be a sort of confusion in the minds of a lot of people, and I've met it more recently. You know, there's been I've met a greater number of instances between the organisation on the one hand and the leadership on the other. And I think this is what's possibly in the mind of the contributor over there. He seems to think that there's, you know, some people like to lead and others like to be led. And there's a sort of, there's a lot that he's left unsaid in that statement. I mean, does he think, for example, that this is an innate characteristic? Does he think it's born into people? Because, you know, I would definitely challenge that view if it were the one he were expressing. I mean, the whole point about leadership and dominating people and bossing them is that it's a function of the society we're brought up in, and we have to change it. And I think one of the things which often bothers people who make this objection is that they sort of they see society as it is, organised in various ways, led and managed and all the rest of it, and they sort of imagine that suddenly all these things are going to be taken away one dark night, as it were, and you know, we're all going to be left without this sort of familiar props that we've been used to all of our lives. Well, of course it won't be like that. What will happen is that people will gradually or less gradually, as the case may be, realise that they don't need to have a class of people basically telling them what to do, or certain people who are thought to have, quote, qualities of leadership, unquote, which often enough means that they're just capable, more capable, they've got a bigger brass neck than most of us of being nasty and sort of telling people to, you know, sort of go and do this, go and do that. They have less of a sort of neck about it, as it were.
Okay, there's another point in the middle, I think. Is that right? Go on. Yeah.
I'd just like to ask the speaker what he thought of the worker that was shown in the film. Here he is, 50-odd years of age, thoroughly indoctrinated, and what hope do you hold out for him to become a socialist? I mean, do you hold out any hope?
Yeah, my father recently, I mean, don't see him that often, when I first gave him the socialist argument, he was sort of like hostile in a way to it, because it threatened what he believed in all his life. But given time to think on the arguments, you know, it's a process, because socialist ideas, people only come across them, unfortunately at the moment, rarely. What a good thing it would be if people came across them once a month or once a week. You know, we denied access to the media. And so when people do hear our ideas, they treat them with ridicule. But incidentally, my dad since then has been asking all these very interesting questions about, you know, similar to that. Who'll do the dirty work and all the rest of it? Who'll do the dirty work? He'll do the dirty work. Why? Because he can see the social society is in his interest and it's a necessary function. And, okay, you know, that's why the person shown in the film, very sincere person as well, you know. Workers are honest, most of them, you know. They want to do what they see is for the best of the community. Unfortunately, at the moment, you see it in the buying and selling system, which can never function in the interest of the community. He'll be a direct candidate for socialism if he had our ideas on a regular basis.
Right. Before we take any more questions, I'd like to thank you very much for a collection of £30 and one penny. And that's not bad for an audience of 50. Request from the landlord, please, when you go downstairs afterwards, take your glasses with you. Who's got questions to put or points to raise? 1, 2, 3. I've gone to someone fresh to start with. We're going to come back in a minute here.
I'd just like to make a comment on that last subject you were talking about the old person and how do you reform sort of mentality. I think the old person reformed his own mentality, time goes by. The older they get, the more ashamed and guilty they become as they look around them and see society changing behind them, as in a sense, through the back door. And then they just sort of refuse to accept what's going on around them. It's just stubborn, sort of, like nationalism, patriotism, inside those old person and his social spirit in a sense. Yeah.
Question at the front, is
there? Oh. Well, I enjoyed the film. I wasn't surprised by it because...
Speak up a bit so I can hear you in the back.
I enjoyed the film. I wasn't surprised by it because we're all brainwashed and conditioned. At the moment we come into the world, whether it's with a plastic spoon or a silver spoon, now on my left here is a conservative, ex-public schoolboy, unemployed, living on social security, and myself, unemployed and also living on social security, but I'm an ex-public schoolboy. Now he still believes in royalty, the aristocracy, and capitalism, because he's been brainwashed into it at the public school, and it hasn't dropped out yet, he's still in it. Really, it's like the Third Reich, it's a type of Third Reich indoctrination. Now, my family were all true blues. My father was a true blue, my mother still is, and I don't even try to brainwash them. It would be like talking in a foreign language. In actual fact, if you don't vote conservative, you're a traitor.
Yeah.
You haven't defended the country at all against invasion, so therefore I wouldn't even waste my time. But I must admit this. What you saw there on that programme was a working class gentleman who believed that he knew his place in society. Went to a state school, and I suppose he worked in a factory or something. On the other side of the coin, you've got what they call the culture and the breeding, and the stiff upper lip brigade. Well, they think they've got a right to rule because they've been conditioned that way. It's not really their fault. It's the way they've been injected from their upbringing. And if you go back through history, right back to the Roman Empire, let's go back some time, you had what they call the patricians, I believe, and the plebeians, I used to call them. Well, it was, and then you go to India, you've still got a caste system in India today, which is even worse than what we've got over here, the untouchables, etc. So it's in human nature to be like this. Now, I don't agree with it. I don't personally agree with it. But I think that once it's stuck in them, like that middle-aged gentleman of the working-class background, and this fellow on my left here who still thinks he's a true blue and he's on the dole, it's in them, and it's stuck in them. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, yeah, you might be true about ruling-class conditioning, you know, but we don't appeal to the ruling class for socialism. We appeal to the working class. If some capitalists want to come in, become socialists, oh, well and good. Well, if they do come in, give some of the money. But they're conditioned to that way of life, you know. Wish I was, I couldn't afford that way of life, but I can't. So I'm a socialist. I'm selfish, you know. I pursue my economic interests. He doesn't. He hasn't, you know. Why not?
Any more questions? Fresh questions? You haven't been in yet. There's a couple more coming in who have.
Yeah, I was just thinking that I don't think it's entirely inevitable that we sort of nurture nationalistic ideas, because I went to a state secondary modern school and I was indoctrinated with nationalistic ideas and all the rest of it. But when this was on the Isle of Wight, and I remember when the Queen, I believe it was the Queen, visited Yarmouth on the Isle of Wight. I didn't feel compelled to go and see her like most of my school friends. I thought it was a better idea to go and sunbathe on the beach. And I remember thinking when I first heard of the Socialist Party that the ideas were just like basically common sense. It's the idea about if you want people to stop fighting one another, then it's obvious that you must have a world without countries. It's very simple, but it's the only way. It's the only starting point for a world of peace.
That's right. It is common sense. I always thought it was. Like I mentioned earlier, this common sense gets drowned out by the way we live today. You know, and people think this is the only society possible. And that's sort of like added on to it all, you know. Oh, well. But looking at that school, the school parade, when they were all singing hymns and saying the prayers to the skies. It's a school for you. Then they're all going to the classroom, and the teacher tells them about how primitive man was backward because he was superstitious. Singing all these hymns. Praying and all that. That's school, though, you know. I don't know what they're doing at the time.
Yeah, by the door.
The last point that you made, certainly I wouldn't approve of my son or daughter going to school like that. However, there obviously is a problem in today's schooling. Kids are wanting to leave school at the earliest possible age. The problem, in my eyes, is not that they seek a job as such. They seek some incentive. And I would have thought that it's only natural that all of us, regardless of our political beliefs, want to feel ambitious about something. Now, having said that, I'd like to go on to say that even though I'm basically a socialist, or I have a socialist spirit at least, I believe that there's nothing wrong with trying to get as much money as you can, being self-employed for that matter, participate even in the capitalist system, because what we are all after is comfort and secure surroundings. That, in my eyes, seems to be only natural. And that's why I come back to your point that I can't accept it, because it doesn't, in my eyes, offer any options.
Answer to that, if you want to.
Well, you know, it seems to me that the present social system destroys incentive, really. What have kids got to come to, you know, leaving school? What have they got to look forward to? YTS, you know. How ambitious is that? You see, there's only so many people who can, you know, who make it, if you want to call it that. The vast majority of capitalists inherit their wealth. The numbers of working-class people who step up, if you can call it that, from the working class into the capitalist class is statistically insignificant. You can work as hard as you like, but if your product doesn't sell in the market, well, you're out of it, you know. And there's nothing as hard as setting up a business. I've spoken to people who really get it off the ground. They work 28 hours a day, 8 days a week, and all the rest of it. And I've seen some disillusioned people who'd say, I did all this and did all that, but there was no demand for my product. It had good plans and all the rest of it. But people are being turned away who are ambitious. Bank managers are saying, Christ, look at this young, enthusiastic person. He wants to do this. You know, but I'm sorry, at the moment, there's no demand for your product. Elbow.
Show the back.
Excuse me. At the moment, we live in a sort of peace state, don't we, right? I want to know how your social...
Well,
whatever it is,
it's going to
help us out there. Or if you can help us out there.
Well, there is a police state. There's varying degrees of...
Hold on, let the speaker deal with it in the front, if possible.
There's very varying degrees of authoritarianism, you know, the hardness, if you like, of a government. In this country, you've got relatively... free association. You can form different political parties and relatives, free speech. You haven't got no money to set up printing presses and all the rest of it, like on Fleet Street, but we can try. By the way, as soon as the ruling class sees its interests threatened, this is when it starts tightening the screw. The miners' strike is a recent example with roadblocks and interrogation of miners. You know, this is a democratic society. You're forced into a police station, you get the light, you know, the light treatment. Now, we're saying the working class, and we're saying to the working class of Russia, who are only allowed to vote for one party, we say it's in your interest to get rid of a police state, to get rid of state, because laws are made, apparently, if you believe the indoctrination process, to keep us all, you know,
in line
and working, you know. If you step out of line, the law, it's a good law, you're put in prison, you're bad for committing an act against private property, which was what most of it amounts to. And rapists and all the rest of these people, the poor unfortunates, who've been, their outlook in life has been distorted by the religious and economic outlooks within capitalism, you know, the patriarchal family and all the rest. But if you don't fit into that rigid structure, well, you're an outcast, a misfit, and all this. We say society doesn't have to be as rigid as this. Socialism is going to be more flexible. Society will adapt to the individual rather than the individual adapting to society.
Any other questions? Quite for a second. Somebody else? No, you're quite welcome in a moment. Somebody hasn't spoken yet there.
Just wanted to make a few comments about that the terrible attitude to education of the it was the MP on that one, wasn't it? Who was talking about you've got to teach them in primary schools, you've got to teach people how to read and how to count. I mean, apart from that being bloody obvious, I hope we all know to do that and far more. That and the government paper, which I've been hearing a bit about recently, about higher education, which suggests, I think even said outright, that higher education should only be available to those people who are going to, in effect, usefully plough their skills back into the capitalist society. And that education, i.e. learning, isn't just something that anybody and everybody should actively engage in as a natural activity. And apart from the rigidity of exams and the system of getting a qualification, it's something that we all owe ourselves, I think, to learn in the widest sense possible by, obviously you've got to do the basics for you, you've got to learn the tools before you can make any use of them, but to educate ourselves by reading, by looking around us, by going and meeting people, by learning from other people's experience in whatever way they want to offer it to us.
Yes, I don't agree that we have a police state. I think that's a very unreasonable statement to me. If you compare the British police to police in other parts of the world, I think British police are angels. Very often, when you get individual officers or even groups of officers in certain parts of Britain overreacting, it's very often because they have been initially provoked. And that has to be taken into account. I think if one is to be reasonable, one should take that into account. The other thing, what you mentioned, or somebody mentioned, I think you actually mentioned it, one should try to understand the offenders of crime. I don't disagree with that at all. However, having said that, I'd like to also say that my house has been burgled a few times. I know a couple of old ladies that have been attacked in the street unjustly. I know of some very serious crimes that have taken place. And I think, one has to be objective about it all. And to just, you know, as a socialist say, we live in a police state and a capitalist system and go on like that, it's all, in my eyes, just for being controversial. One has to be reasonable, and that's the only way that you will completely condition me into your way of thinking, by being reasonable, by looking at the whole aspect of crime, police, capitalism, and socialism objectively.
But that's sort of like looking scientifically at causes and effects, you know, in society. You've got to look at why there is crime in the first place. Once there is, you know, a set of laws, and if you break a law, it's a crime. Why that crime takes place. I mean, there's many muggings in do many capitalists commit muggings?
I wouldn't trust
that. Do many unemployed people commit muggings?
Well, not many.
Well, I would think the majority of muggers and things like that come from people who are economically bankrupt, if you like. They're desperate, you know, they can't find work. Or in some cases, might be in a low-paid job.
So you don't think it's a... sorry to interrupt you, but you don't think it's a horrendous crime, then?
I certainly do. It's terrible crime, all people getting mugged and all that. You know, I want to end it. And there's been reform after reform after reform. Capitalism cannot end it, and never will end it. Because it's based upon private property. A minority, you know, a minority of people monopolise it. And the majority have to go without. You can't expect... You say you want people to be reasonable. You can't expect people to wake up and say, I've got no job, I've got no house, I've got no this. And look around and say, they've got this, they've got that. You can't expect them to say, I'll be reasonable about it, this is the way things are. We socialists, if you like, we're sort of reasonable about it. We see a political solution. And we don't condone people... seeing a way out of their poverty through crime, because you're going to end up behind bars. But you tell me where capitalism's short, sharp shock or any other so-called reform has worked. It never will. You've got to recognise that fundamental fact that there's a conflict within society. Only socialism will remove it.
So what do you do?
We work to establish a classless society. Nothing can be done immediately. Like I've just explained, there's been hundreds of reforms in crime, police, housing, employment, pensions, you name it. Problem never goes away. It might temporarily get a bit better.
Quite right.
In a boom situation in capitalism. As soon as there's a slump, all the benefits, you know, given by the capitalist class are took away from them. And Labour governments operate in that same way as well. 1977, they started the cuts in welfare state spending, public spending.
Yeah.
Can I just take the point at the front?
I was thinking there's one thing we haven't covered very well, I think, in my opinion, and that is the worry about coloured people taking the jobs. What I really wanted to say is, how did Britain treat all our colonies, or what did they do to get them? I'm still horrified at my age at what we really did to get them. And those same people never spoke a word about what they were doing there.
Yeah, there's a famous quotation. I wish I had it, but I haven't. I can't remember it. It's something like some former colonel or something. He's going on about we didn't go over to India and places like that for the benefit of the Indians, to raise the Indians, you know, like missionaries and that. We went over there to claim India as an outlet for the goods of Great Britain. We took it by the sword and we held it by the sword. Was it that economic motive, what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Which socialism will eliminate. But getting on to the immigration problem. There's more people leave this country now than come in. Those are the facts. Yet unemployment is rising. And how in Glasgow, when there's very few blacks, immigrants, how come that is one, and Northern Ireland, is one of the highest rates of unemployment? It's a nonsensical argument used by people who are desperate and seek simple solutions and want to take it out in scapegoats. It's a fallacy. It's wrong.
Right, we've got time just for two or three more questions. I can see there's one or two hands up, but I really want to see, if possible, take points from people who've not spoken yet. It'd be nice to hear from those people, and there's quite a few of them who've not been in. If not, quite free not to, and we'll go to... Yeah, Sandy.
Well, I just wanted to say something about the question of police state. I'm actually quite sympathetic in one way to what the contributor over there actually said about this. I think that phrases like this are often used as a sort of simple resort to some sort of term of abuse, as it were. It's like the left wingers calling their opponents fascists or imperialists. It's like one Socialist Party speaker once described these two words as political swear words. Now, I mean, it's quite obvious that in the case of some of the left-wingers, they're just as much fascists, and they undoubtedly support imperialists. But coming on to the particular question of police state, I would still like to say to this contributor, he seems to have a rather rosier view of the police than what would be justified by recent events. And let me just stress something here.
I am not saying that anybody who joins the police force is some sort of a raving, power-mad, fanatical, you know, that to join the police force you have to be ultra-right-wing and all the rest of it. Although, mind you, it does help. I might say that. It does help. Because those are the sort of attitudes which most clearly underpin the sort of values that the police are ultimately there to protect. I mean, the fact of the matter is that when four policemen get one minor down in his belly, beat all the strength out of his arms and legs, and then just for good measure twist his arms up his back, you know, just as a sort of... The guy actually commented that he thought they wanted to take his right arm away as a souvenir. Well, I mean, when that sort of thing happens, we're in a different situation from the police simply responding to provocation. When they go into people's houses and, you know, cause actual terror, it's no exaggeration to say that they cause terror in some of the instances of the miners' strike. Other situations. I dare say if you're a black in Brixton, you'll know something about it as well. And indeed, if there are any people of West Indian or Asian origin who live in Brixton or anywhere else in this city, I'd be actually quite glad to hear from them about this question of the police, because in Brixton in particular, it seems to have been a problem which has been festered for years and years and years. There have been various attempts, sort of half-sincere and half-window dressing to sort of solve the problem. I mean, the police are workers just like the rest of us, incidentally. They are. Indeed, when those coppers beat the shite out of the miner, they were actually only doing their job, I might say. That is all they were doing, helping to keep order in a capitalist society, which is what they're there for. So I would really ask the contributor over there, if he's still with us, and anybody who thinks the same way as he does, although we don't want to rush to condemn people on sort of slim evidence, the evidence which has accrued over the past, over recent times, has been evident slim, and, you know, it has got to be faced up to that there are definite attempts being used in this country now, at the present time, and have been for the things must have been in preparation for ages, to sort of, use the instruments of the state in a positively hostile way to any sort of protest that has come about. And however the people may see themselves acting, people like Margaret, I think Margaret Thatcher seriously believes that she's defending the right, incidentally. I think that she seriously thinks she's a great sort of speaker and actor for what is morally good. Nevertheless, what they end up doing, and what, to a large extent, a lot of them are quite consciously doing, is defending the institutions of property and keeping this present society going.
Right, a quick response from the speaker.
Yeah, I was listening to a policeman on the radio this morning. He was saying, you know, all this about policemen getting lots of wages and everything else. He says, after working shifts around the clock, 24 hours, and overtime, you know, the average wage and everything, they're lucky to come out with £130 a week. Okay, it's better than a lot of workers, it's about the average wage. But workers who were policing the miners' strike, they know these miners, you know, they don't like this conflict. The people who cause this conflict, the coal board and the economic system of capitalism, they're the people who cause it, but they don't take part where it takes most effect. In the community, it's up a working class against working class. It's tragic. It's very understandable that miners see police as enemies and all the rest of it, but they've got to see a bit further. They've got to be tough with their brains, not police as some other class or somebody else. They've got to recognise that they're the same. They depend upon selling their labour power for a wage to exist. It's poverty, no matter how much wages you get.
I think one has to remember that when socialists talk about capital, we're talking about the world, we're talking about the United Kingdom. In Great Britain, relatively speaking, we have a benign police force compared to what the police are like, say, in Russia, in Eastern Europe, in South America, in Central America, in Africa. We have a relatively benign police force, although the way in which the country of police has considerably changed over the past two decades. We're talking in terms of world capitalism in most of the parts of the world. I mean, we do have police states. So one mustn't lose both of the world.
I'll answer that one. Right. Mm-hmm.
Just
make your watch.
On that, matter of the police.
What's to make?
It's
a convent.
All themselves and probably they'd be sure it was all themselves. That if the police hadn't gained that top line during the miners' strike, they knew that they were under the threat of the army movement, that is the commandos in a sense, the real police. And this was shown when Peel introduced the police force into many sort of like towns and villages throughout England in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But they had to establish them by the presence of the army. The body was left, the corporal was left, and they were stoned, or else it was driven out by a pitchfork. The army had to come in 2, 3, 4, 5 times in order to establish this constable of the peace. I think the police have always been under this threat, and even during the miners' strike, they realised it themselves. And I mean, you can take sort of like sociological evidence, and you can take literary evidence even. Take the BBC's Let's Play the Detective and things like that. And that's given a policeman's point of view on, you know, the politicisation of the police.
Right, well, in answer to the gentleman at the door, sitting on the stool, this is not a democracy. You're as free as the money in your back pocket. That's the first thing. Secondly, the other fellow at the other end is on about police brutality. The majority of the police that put the boot in on the miners weren't police. They were military policemen brought over from Germany and slung into a copper's uniform, because I happen to have a couple of fellows I used to go to grammar school with who are in the MPs. Right, that is it. That's the first thing. Because some of the things they were doing, they were taught to do in the army. Now, that's it. Now, the question I want to ask the gentleman here, the speaker, is this. I have taken an interest in socialism and communism for 3 years. Maoists, Stalinists, Trotskyists, and this brand of utopian socialism. Now, unless everybody wakes up in the morning after reading the Socialist Standard and has a complete conversion to socialism, irrespective of what their background is, and bring about world socialism, that's one thing. But the question I want to ask the gentleman here is, what's the difference between you and the Trotskys, or what they call the Trots?
Yeah, right. First of all, you know, you can come back later on it, maybe. You say you've been interested in communism, socialism. You say it's set up a part of the world. I'd like to know where to start, because all I can see in the world is wages systems, profits, and, you know, wage slavery. So you give us some proof. It's all right with the rhetoric, but, you know. Now, first of all, wasn't the Trotskyists? Well, Trotskyists, basically people who say the working class cannot understand that socialism will be there in their interests under capitalist conditions. So they say they've got to change these material conditions and set up a workers' state by means of an insurrection. And in this process of... it's completely historically redundant. This is before the modern state built up its, you know, invincible weaponry. No one's going to beat it. Going on this, you know, knocking policemen's hats off and building barricades. But this is what the Trotskyists say. You've got to get this. And in the process of all this fighting, workers are somehow going to become socialist. They understand that it's in their interest to cooperate, voluntary cooperation and all that, you know. It's a myth. It stems back to, you know, tradition. We always accept, like Marx accepted, that the working class is capable of self-emancipation. The working class, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself. They can obtain the socialist consciousness by self-association without leaders or with outside help. Lenin and the other Bolsheviks formulated this theory that the working class is unable to do this. They're only able to get a trade union consciousness. They said that the working class is incapable of understanding socialism. When they said that to me, I said, you know, they didn't say it. They never say this to people, of course. They just say, oh, vote, you know, they asked you to vote Labour. And when you get in there, the workers will see how redundant Labour is, this will make them more socialist, you know. They don't believe in talking to workers about socialism, for some reason. I don't know why. It's an elitist belief. But Lenin said, and they never mention it in their literature, their papers. I've never seen a definition of socialism. You know, they never talk about raising socialist consciousness through the ideas of it. Lenin said, workers can only understand socialism through a process of this revolution, you know, by a vanguard party getting state power. And then it can only be introduced, they're going to establish socialism, see, according to them, and for the workers, and the workers are going to cooperate, even though they haven't sort of like placed their acceptance of socialism on record, you know. Right? This always leads to state capitalism.
Yes, come on, Chairman. The point was, before discussing that topic, when they had seen to this, I don't know who they were, Lord and Lady Muck or something, with their dogs parading in front of the cameras. And, you know, they put it in a nutshell. They said, well, you know, how have we got this? Well, we've got it because it was inherited. And, you know, this is absolutely correct. I mean, the majority of the ruling class are where they are today because of what has been passed down to them. And what has been passed down to them from before was previously passed down before that, and so on and so on. Where did it originally come from? Well, it was plundered. And looked at in another way, you know, because of that, I'm talking about the majority of people in this room, and the majority of people in society are in the working class, and they're in the working class because all that we've inherited is working class poverty, because we're the other side of the coin. And the point I'm trying to make basically is that when you think about it, this position that they're in, that they've inherited, well, there's nothing sort of natural about it. I mean, if there was something natural about it, then there'd be nothing that we could do. But the point is that there's no earthly reason why everything that's in the world and the majority of stuff that's in the world should belong to a few people. There's no reason for that at all. What is really lacking is the consciousness, working class consciousness and understanding and education to bring that about. Because I maintain that once people understand what is going on in large numbers, the game is up. And there'll be no more capitalism because people will refuse to go along with it. And they will organise themselves throughout the world into socialist parties, and they will organise themselves to get rid of it. And there's going to be no more playing the game to say, right, the game is up, that's it. Socialism is on the agenda. Socialism is the only movement today that is on the agenda, because the left wing are all at sea. They're completely all at sea. They're just running round and round in bloody circles. And I read recently the Socialist Workers' Party wants to form an alliance with the militant, and they want to urge the working class again to vote for the Labour Party. Not because they're going to make any change. They actually admit that the Labour Party isn't for the working class, but they want to test again that the policies are wrong. I mean, how stupid can you get? We in this party advocate socialism and nothing but, and we have a clear understanding of how that can be brought about. And I would urge people who are interested in socialist ideas to join in the Socialist Party, because it is the only progressive movement today.
Yeah, right.
Can I just reflect on that point?
There's a statement
on the television today from a clinic somewhere in London, and the media weren't allowed to know why John Paul Getty, was in this clinic. He passed over £20 million. He says there's another £30 million coming across to buy some works of art and that. He says, I've got so much bread, I don't know what to do. He says, I can't spend it in my lifetime, you know.
There's no words come from.
And they just would not divulge this information, what it was in there for. I mean, we know, people that know Getty, that it was in there for one reason and one reason only. Because he was a heroin addict, and he cannot cope with life. His father promised to cut him out of his will if he didn't reform his ways. He lived with the workers, and they realised that they were the sole producers of wealth. And the guy cannot cope with it. He's destined to sort of like die an existence of, unless we revolutionise this society and sort of like give him a bit of peace of mind. There is a capitalist. There's about to work.
Right, we've got time for one or two quick points if anybody wants to have a final shot at it.
There is one there. Anyone else? It's going to be the last chance. Right, that's two. Right, I'll take you first, Andy, and then we'll finish on that. Can you be very brief, please?
Well, I'll certainly attempt to be brief, Common Chairman. I'm more known for that than a certain other gentleman with a beard at the back of the room here. But let's just put it this way. As a citizen of this country, the United Kingdom, as it's euphemistically known, I'm in a bit of a quandary, actually. Let's get back to this subject of nationalism, which is what we started off with. I'm in a wee bit of a quandary.